Last spring, my wife Barbara and I took a trip around the world. We traveled by air and by car, just by ourselves, but meeting up with friends just for the last leg. We were gone for 9 weeks. During that time, I missed the Sunday services here, but my UU beliefs traveled right along with me. After we came back, I asked myself how those UU convictions affect the way I see the world around me. What do the messages we hear in this sanctuary mean when they confront the big world out there beyond our congregation? Is my spiritual journey just a metaphor, or is it part of my real journey around the globe? This morning I want to reflect on these questions. I'll organize my remarks around the 7 UU principles that we just read. If you're keeping score, I must tell you that I don't feel bound by their exact phrasing. Geographically, I'll take you to 3 countries: South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand. Our South African adventure began in the northeastern corner of that vast country. We stayed for 5 days in the game preserve Kapama, which is part of the Greater Kruger National Park, an animal sanctuary about half the size of Virginia. Twice a day, our ranger Tim took us on a 3-hour safari in an open car that you see here. Since our little group of 6 guests always traveled in the same car with Tim, who served as both driver and guide, we got to know him very well. On a raised seat attached to the car's front fender, which is on the wrong side because they drive on the wrong side down there, sat a native spotter whose job it was to point out fresh animal tracks. He communicated with Tim by gestures and rarely said a word. Under their guidance, we saw hundreds of animals in the wild, representing dozens of species, ranging from high-stepping giraffes, lumbering elephants, and sturdy little zebras, down to tiny, elusive monkeys and the rear end of a humongous python, of which we never got to see the front. But of course, the most impressive were the lions. The proverbial kings of the jungle were worth a trip all by themselves. This is Min's picture. The first time we came upon a lioness lying in the grass, not 15 feet from us, with her 2 cubs playing nearby, was a peak experience. Tim drove the big car so slowly that it was almost soundless. He had cautioned us to be silent and to turn off the flash on our cameras, and above all, to remain in our seats. The wild animals in the park are so used to the silhouette of the safari vehicles that they ignore them. But sudden changes, or worse, people standing up or walking outside the cars, they interpret those as threats, which scare them into unpredictable behavior. Game reserve animals are not tame, but they have accepted the big Land Rovers as part of their environment, no more threatening than the trees and bushes and watering holes that form the familiar furniture of their home. The experience of meeting the lions was transcendent in its peacefulness. Tim cut off the engine, and we sat still. Nobody stirred. Nothing happened. Although the sun was already high in the sky, the morning was still cool. The lioness looked at us occasionally before lowering her head back down onto her enormous paws. Her dusty golden flanks heaved rhythmically as she breathed, loudly enough to hear in the silence of the bush. The cameras of the Japanese couple sitting behind us clicked softly. The tracker dozed. The wind rustled in the trees. Africa slumbered. What struck me was how patient we all were, and especially how patient I was. We sat there watching for a good 20 minutes, and I would happily have stayed all morning. The scene had none of the dramatic impact of a National Geographic photograph or a spectacular nature movie, and none of the implicit tensions of a visit to the zoo. So what was so special about it? Why did it affect me so deeply? I think that the power of that gentle encounter lay in the simple experience of full mutual awareness. We humans were fully focused on the lioness, and she, in turn, was keenly aware of us. Such mutual awareness is obviously absent from movies and photographs. And in a zoo, animals and visitors perceive each other in a nervous mix of curiosity, fear, boredom, anger, and impatience. Here in the bush, on the other hand, humans and animals were reduced to a state of simple, placid existential awareness. This, I thought, is the deeper meaning of the seventh UU principle, our respect for the interdependent web of life, the undemanding, uncomplicated awareness of each other's being. That's what weaves us into an interdependent web. The lioness and I, we were in this thing together, and somehow, at a deeply spiritual level, we both knew it. Barbara and I communicated with humans, too, in South Africa, lots of them. It turned out that we had inadvertently picked an exceptionally auspicious time for our visit. 2014 marks the 20th anniversary of the election of Nelson Mandela to the presidency in April of 1994. Although he died last year, the occasion was one of joy. They have a special name for the event. They call it Freedom and Democracy, a ringing phrase in any context. Freedom and democracy. Wherever we went in South Africa, on TV, in the papers, on street posters, and in daily conversation, the words freedom and democracy evoked a mood of optimism, of national pride in past achievement, and hope for the future, of youthfulness and energy. Sure, South Africa has enormous problems as a nation, but in April 2014, those were put aside for a much-needed celebratory pause. The public memorials ranged from the monumental to the tiny impromptu outpourings of feelings, such as this personal shrine to Madiba, which is the South African name of Mandela. To me, freedom and democracy seemed almost surreal. There was a time in the early 1990s when I, along with most people in the world, I suspect, I was convinced that the tension between the races in South Africa was so intense that it could only end in a bloodbath. What form that catastrophe would take, nobody knew, but that it was coming was thought to be inevitable. Yet here we were, a mere 20 years later, celebrating freedom and democracy. The anticipated bloodbath had been averted. The eyes and voices of the people we met were experiencing, in the eyes of and voices of the people we met, I was experiencing a reaffirmation of the fifth UU principle, the endorsement of the democratic process. In the face of depressing news from all over the globe, freedom and democracy helped me to restore the balance between heartbreak and hope that Jennifer encourages all of us to strive for. In this way, travel, even to a troubled land like South Africa, can calm the spirit, soothe the soul, and energize us to further transformative action. From South Africa, we flew to Sydney, Australia, for a week of rest from our strenuous vacation. Of course, the famous Opera House was our first goal. But as travelers know, unexpected adventures turn out to be the most memorable. Two blocks from our apartment, Sydney's annual love parade wended its noisy way through the old town. We had seen several gay pride parades in other parts of the world, and were curious to compare them. Whereas the big Paris bash is famous for its brazen, excessive exhibitionism, a different spirit seemed to animate the Sydney version. The emphasis here was more on inclusiveness than on shock value. Besides the expected LGBT community, anybody who wanted to join in marched down the street. The Army marched, the Navy marched, the Fire Department marched, the police marched, unions joined ranks. It was a glorious, hilarious, chaotic festival of love. It seemed as though all the citizens of Sydney were out to proclaim publicly that they support their fellow humans, regardless of race, creed, or sexual preference. I was surprised and moved. When I was in college over 50 years ago, my gay friends routinely faced harassment. And it wasn't until 2011, a mere 3 years ago, that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. Yet here we stood, watching the armed forces of Australia in full uniform marching in support of gay pride. The second UU principle was on parade that night. Justice, equity, and compassion in human relations triumphed. But I am not a Pollyanna who finds something to be glad about in every situation I encounter. Not everything in the Southern Hemisphere is peaceful, joyful, or compassionate. In every country we visited, the ugly scars of past exploitation were in plain view. In South Africa, people of color will take decades to achieve real racial equality. In Australia, the Aborigines are just beginning to be treated fairly. In New Zealand, the Maori are perhaps further along towards true integration into their society than even African Americans and Native Americans are in ours. But the wrongs they have suffered until the very recent past are not forgotten. Every stop on our trip reminded us that the sixth UU principle, the vision of a peaceful world community, is a worthy but distant goal. In that depressing context, it is heartwarming to witness an occasional phoenix, that mythical bird with its flamboyant gold and crimson plumage rising out of the ashes of catastrophe. We encountered such a miracle in the town of Christchurch on the South Island of New Zealand. 3 years ago, just before 1 p.m. in the afternoon of February 22, 2011, a powerful earthquake shook the ground for 12 seconds with a violence that has been estimated to occur once in 1,000 years. That only 185 people died was principally due to the fact that in that region, which is prone to earthquakes, building codes are both stringent and strictly enforced. The damage of the quake still dominates the downtown of the city and will take decades to erase. Perhaps the saddest symbol of the disaster is the ruin in the center of town of the famous Christ Church Cathedral, an Anglican church that took 40 years, from 1864 to 1904, to build, and 12 seconds to fall down. The Christchurch quake and the cathedral were front-page news throughout the world. They caught the attention of the Japanese architect Chigoro Ban, who specializes in humanitarian and emergency building projects. He offered to design a contemporary home for the Christ Church congregation pro bono, and thus was born the monument of modern architecture known as the Cardboard Cathedral. The skeleton of the Cardboard Cathedral is an A-frame consisting of 100 long, hollow cardboard tubes arranged like the fingers of 2 tented hands, like that. If you have ever tried to break a mailing tube, you will have been surprised by its strength. If it's made thick enough and covered with a protective coating of polyurethane, it forms a cheap, convenient, and readily available building element. In Christchurch, the humble cardboard tube reached its 15 minutes of world fame. Architect Ban's church was concentrated in 2013, just 2 years after the earthquake, not 40, but 2 years. It seats 700 worshipers and serves as the spiritual home for the Anglican congregation of the city. By its unusual construction, it attracts a steady stream of tourists, but its appeal far exceeds its curiosity value. Its simple elegance, the splendid color of its windows, its impressive height, and especially the dramatic background story, all those help to endow it with a palpable aura of spiritual power. The third UU principle encourages spiritual growth in our congregation, but our own WUU covenant puts it even more appropriately. We promise each other to renew ourselves through shared educational, artistic, and spiritual experiences. How hopeful and reassuring these words would have sounded to the devastated Christ Church congregation. We promise each other to renew ourselves through shared artistic experiences. That's what the Cardboard Cathedral did. A week after Barbara and I returned from New Zealand, we opened the New York Times to learn that Shigeru Ban has received this year's Pritzker Prize, the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for Architecture. Let me return once more to South Africa. At its southernmost tip, Cape Town is a city of extremes. By choice, the mansions of the super-rich crowd along the beaches. By necessity, the poor are crowded into what are called townships, segregated villages that dot the landscape further inland. Townships, which became ghettos in the era of apartheid, have evolved considerably since then. They are large, often with 50,000 or more inhabitants. While the government is building simple individual cottages as fast as possible, and cars have lined some of the streets, a large fraction of the homes are ramshackle shanties cobbled together from sheet metal and plastic. We hired a young guide to show us around Langa Township near Cape Town. He is a native of Langa, an extrovert and people person who chose to stay close to his family and his community. On the street, all the girls flocked around him. He took us upstairs to a government-run hostel for single men. In a room the size of our own church library, furnished principally by the neatly stacked suitcases of its three occupants, an elderly black man sat on a bed. Through our guide, he told us his story. He had worked in Langa for 28 years and sent money to his wife and family to a village far up north. When he retired, he moved back there, but soon fell ill. The only place he could get medical treatment was back in Langa. So he returned alone and was living out the rest of his days in that primitive, lonely room with nothing but his memories to nourish his soul. We shook his hand and thanked him for allowing us to visit. Afterwards, Barbara and I agreed that this desperately poor old man, who uncomplainingly bore his misfortune, nevertheless managed to convey an incredible sense of calm, poise, and self-respect. Barbara turned to me and said, "I have never met anyone else with so much dignity. To me, he will henceforth embody the first and perhaps preeminent principle of our faith, the inherent worth and dignity of every person." The UU principle are the 7 flagpoles of our faith. As we go about our lives, we lay flowers at their bases, offerings in the form of our personal experiences, our thoughts, our insights. From our travels, we bring back fresh, colorful, and fragrant bouquets to express our overflowing feelings. But even at home, in our daily routine, we can pick wildflowers by the side of the road or pretty stones, humble gifts to adorn those bare flagpoles and turn them into living shrines. So may it be.